A Canticle for Leibowitz by Walter M. Miller, Jr. Continued. Cassette 1, Side 2. One could tell by a glance at the stones that inner hatch had been blocked not by today's rock slide, but by one more ancient than the abbey itself. If fallout shelter's sealed environment contained a fallout, the demon had obviously not opened inner hatch since the time of the flame deluge before the simplification. And if it had been sealed beyond the metal door for so many centuries, there was small reason, Francis told himself, to fear that it might come bursting through the hatch before Holy Saturday. His torch burned low. Having found a splintered chair leg, he set it ablaze with his waning flame, then began gathering broken bits of furniture with which to build a dependable fire, meanwhile pondering the meaning of that ancient sign, Fallout Survival Shelter. As Brother Francis readily admitted, his mastery of pre-deluge English was far from masterful yet. The way nouns could sometimes modify other nouns in that tongue had always been one of his weak points. In Latin, as in most simple dialects of the region, a construction like servus puer meant about the same thing as puer servus, and even in English, slave boy meant boy slave. But there the similarity ended. He had finally learned that house cat did not mean cat house, and that a dative of purpose or possession, as in mihi amicus, was somehow conveyed by dog food or sentry box, even without inflection. But what of a triple appositive like fallout survival shelter? Brother Francis shook his head. The warning on inner hatch mentioned food, water, and air, and yet surely these were not necessities for the fiends of hell. At times, the novice found pre-deluge English more perplexing than either intermediate angelology or St. Leslie's theological calculus. He built his fire on the slopes of the rubble pile, where it could brighten the darker crannies of the antechamber. Then he went to explore whatever might remain uncovered by debris. The ruins above ground had been reduced to archaeological ambiguity by generations of scavengers, but this underground ruin had been touched by no hand but the hand of impersonal disaster. The place seemed haunted by the presences of another age. A skull, lying among the rocks in a darker corner, still retained a gold tooth in its grin, clear evidence that the shelter had never been invaded by wanderers. The gold incisor flickered when the fire danced high. More than once in the desert had Brother Francis encountered, near some parched arroyo, a small heap of human bones, picked clean and whitening in the sun. He was not especially squeamish, and one expected such things. He was therefore not startled when he first noticed the skull in the corner of the antechamber, but the flicker of gold in its grin kept catching his eye while he pried at the doors, locked or stuck, of the rusty lockers, and tugged at the drawers, also stuck, of a battered metal desk. The desk might prove to be a priceless find, if it contained documents or a small book or two that had survived the angry bonfires of the Age of Simplification. While he kept trying to open the drawers, the fire burned low. He fancied that the skull began emitting a faint glow of its own. Such a phenomenon was not especially uncommon, but in the gloomy crypt, Brother Francis found it somehow most disturbing. He gathered more wood for the fire, returned to jerk and tug at the desk, and tried to ignore the skull's flickering grin. While a little wary yet of lurking fallouts, Francis had sufficiently recovered from his initial fright to realize that the shelter, notably the desk and the lockers, might well be teeming with rich relics of an age which the world had, for the most part, deliberately chosen to forget. Providence had bestowed a blessing here. To find a bit of the past which had escaped both the bonfires and the looting scavengers was a rare stroke of luck these days. There was, however, always a risk involved. Monastic excavators, alert for ancient treasures, had been known to emerge from a hole in the ground, triumphantly carrying a strange, cylindrical artifact, and then, while cleaning it or trying to ascertain its purpose, press the wrong button or twist the wrong knob, thereby ending the matter without benefit of clergy. Only 80 years ago, the venerable Bodilus had written with obvious delight to his Lord Abbot that his small expedition had uncovered the remains of, in his own words, the site of an intercontinental launching pad complete with several fascinating subterranean storage tanks. No one at the Abbey ever knew what the venerable Bodilus meant by intercontinental launching pad, but the Lord Abbot who had reigned at that time sternly decreed that monastic antiquarians must, on pain of excommunication, avoid such pads thenceforth. For his letter to the abbot was the last that anyone ever saw of the venerable Bodilus, his party, his launching pad site, and the small village which had grown up over that site. An interesting lake now graced the landscape where the village had been, thanks to some shepherds who diverted the course of a creek and caused it to flow into the crater to store water for their flocks in time of drought. A traveler who had come from that direction about a decade ago reported excellent fishing in that lake, but the shepherds thereabouts regarded the fish as the souls of the departed villagers and excavators. They refused to fish there because of Bo Dallas, the giant catfish that brooded in the deep. Nor shall any other excavation be initiated which does not have as its primary purpose the augmentation of the memorabilia, the Lord Abbot's decree had added, meaning that Brother Francis should search the shelter only for books and papers, not tampering with interesting hardware. The gold-capped tooth kept winking and glittering at the corner of his eye while Brother Francis heaved and strained at the desk drawers. The drawers refused to budge. He gave the desk a final kick and turned to glare impatiently at the skull. "Why don't you grin at something else for a change?" The grin remained. The gold-toothed residuum lay with its head pillowed between a rock and a rusty metal box. Quitting the desk, the novice picked his way across the debris at last for a closer inspection of the mortal remains. Clearly, the person had died on the spot, struck down by the torrent of stones and half buried by the debris. Only the skull and the bones of one leg had not been covered. The femur was broken, the back of the skull was crushed. Brother Francis breathed a prayer for the departed, then very gently lifted the skull from its resting place and turned it around so that it grinned toward the wall. Then his eye fell on the rusty box. The box was shaped like a satchel and was obviously a carrying case of some kind. It might have served any number of purposes, but it had been rather badly battered by flying stones. Gingerly he worked it loose from the rubble and carried it closer to the fire. The lock seemed to be broken, but the lid had rusted shut. The box rattled when he shook it. It was not an obvious place to look for books or papers, but, obviously, too, it was designed to be opened and closed, and might contain a scrap or two of information for the memorabilia. Nevertheless, remembering the fate of Brother Bodilus and others, he sprinkled it with holy water before attempting to pry it open, and he handled the ancient relic as reverently as was possible, while battering at its rusty hinges with a stone. At last he broke the hinges, and the lid fell free. Small metal tidbits bounced from trays, spilled among the rocks, some of them falling irretrievably into crevices. But in the bottom of the box, in the space beneath the trays, he beheld papers. After a quick prayer of thanksgiving, he regathered as many of the scattered tidbits as he could, and, after loosely replacing the lid, began climbing the hill of debris toward the stairwell and the thin patch of sky, with the box hugged tightly under one arm. The sun was blinding after the darkness of the shelter. He scarcely bothered to notice that it was sinking dangerously low in the west, but began at once to search for a flat slab on which the contents of the box could be spread for examination without risk of losing anything in the sand. Minutes later, seated on a cracked foundation slab, he began removing the tidbits of metal and glass that filled the trays. Most of them were small, tubular things, with a wire whisker at the end of each tube. These he had seen before. The Abbey's small museum had a few of them, of various size, shape, and color. Once he had seen a shaman of the hill pagan people wearing a string of them as a ceremonial necklace. The hill people thought of them as parts of the body of the god, of the fabled Machina Analytica, hailed as the wisest of their gods. By swallowing one of them, a shaman could acquire infallibility, they said. He certainly acquired indisputability that way among his own people, unless he swallowed one of the poison kind. The similar tidbits in the museum were connected together, too, not in the form of a necklace, but as a complex and rather disorderly maze in the bottom of a small box, exhibited as radio chassis, application uncertain. Inside the lid of the carrying case, a note had been glued, The glue had powdered, the ink had faded, and the paper was so darkened by rusty stains that even good handwriting would have been hard enough to read. But this was written in a hasty scrawl. He studied it intermittently while emptying the trays. It seemed to be English, of a sort, but half an hour passed before he deciphered most of the message. Carl, must grab plane for, undecipherable, in 20 minutes. For God's sake, keep M there till we know if we're at war. Please, try to get her on the alternate list for the shelter. Can't get her a seat on my plane. Don't tell her why I sent her over with this box of junk, but try to keep her there till we know, undecipherable, at worst, one of the alternates not show. I.E.L. P.S. I put the seal on the lock and put top secret on the lid just to keep M from looking inside. First toolbox I happened to grab. Shove it in my locker or something. The note seemed hasty gibberish to Brother Francis, who was at the moment too excited to concentrate on any single item more than the rest. After a final sneer at the note writer's hasty scrawl, he began the task of removing the tray racks to get at the papers in the bottom of the box. The trays were mounted on a swinging linkage, which was obviously meant to swing the trays out of the box in stair-step array, but the pins were rusted fast, and Francis found it necessary to pry them out with a short steel tool from one of the tray compartments. When Brother Francis had removed the last tray, he touched the papers reverently. Only a handful of folded documents here, and yet a treasure, for they had escaped the angry flames of the simplification, wherein even sacred writings had curled, blackened, and withered into smoke, while ignorant mobs howled and hailed it a triumph. He handled the papers as one might handle holy things, shielding them from the wind with his habit, for all were brittle and cracked from age. There was a sheaf of rough sketches and diagrams. There were hand-scribbled notes, two large folded papers, and a small book entitled Memo. First he examined the jotted notes. They were scrawled by the same hand that had written the note glued to the lid, and the penmanship was no less abominable. Pound pastrami, said one note. Can kraut, 6 bagels. Bring home for Emma. Another reminded, remember, pick up form 1040, Uncle Revenue. Another was only a column of figures with a circled total, from which a second amount was subtracted and finally a percentage taken, followed by the word damn. Brother Francis checked the figures. He could find no fault with the abominable penman's arithmetic, at least, although he could deduce nothing about what the quantities might represent. Memo he handled with special reverence, because the title was suggestive of memorabilia. Before opening it, he crossed himself and murmured the blessing of texts. But the small book proved a disappointment. He had expected printed matter, but found only a handwritten list of names, places, numbers, and dates. The dates ranged through the latter part of the 5th decade and earlier part of the 6th decade, 20th century. Again, it was affirmed, the contents of the shelter came from the twilight period of the Age of Enlightenment. An important discovery, indeed. Of the larger folded papers, one was tightly rolled as well, and it began to fall apart when he tried to unroll it. He could make out the words, racing form, but nothing more. After returning it to the box for later restorative work, he turned to the second folded document. Its creases were so brittle that he dared inspect only a little of it, by parting the folds slightly and peering between them. A diagram, it seemed, but a diagram of white lines on dark paper. Again he felt the thrill of discovery. It was clearly a blueprint, and there was not a single original blueprint left at the Abbey, but only inked facsimiles of several such prints. The originals had faded long ago from overexposure to light. Never before had Francis seen an original, although he had seen enough hand-painted reproductions to recognize it as a blueprint, which, while stained and faded, remained legible after so many centuries because of the total darkness and low humidity in the shelter. He turned the document over and felt brief fury. What idiot had desecrated the priceless paper? Someone had sketched absent-minded geometrical figures and childish cartoon faces all over the back. What thoughtless vandal! The anger passed after a moment's reflection. At the time of the deed, blueprints had probably been as common as weeds, and the owner of the box the probable culprit. He shielded the print from the sun with his own shadow while trying to unfold it further. In the lower right-hand corner was a printed rectangle containing, in simple block letters, various titles, dates, patent numbers, reference numbers, and names. His eye traveled down the list until it encountered Circuit Design by Leibowitz, I.E. He closed his eyes tightly and shook his head until it seemed to rattle. Then he looked again. There it was, quite plainly. Circuit Design by Leibowitz, I.E. He flipped the paper over again. Among the geometric figures and childish sketches, clearly stamped in purple ink, was the form, a square box, entitled This File Copy 2. Open box SUPV, open box PLNT, open box with checkmark DSGN, handwritten IE Leibowitz, open box ENGR, open box ARMY. The name was written in a clear feminine hand, not in the hasty scrawl of the other notes. He looked again at the initialed signature of the note in the lid of the box, IEL, and again at Circuit Design by, and the same initials appeared elsewhere throughout the notes. There had been arguments, all highly conjectural, about whether the beatified founder of the order, if finally canonized, should be addressed as St. Isaac or as St. Edward. Some even favored St. Leibowitz as the proper address, since the Beatus had, until the present, been referred to by his surname.
Beate Leibowitz, ora pro me, whispered Brother Francis.
His hands were trembling so violently that they threatened to ruin the brittle documents. He had uncovered relics of the saint. Of course, New Rome had not yet proclaimed that Leibowitz was a saint, but Brother Francis was so convinced of it that he made bold to add,
Sancte Leibowitz, ora pro me.
Brother Francis wasted no idle logic in leaping to his immediate conclusion. He had just been granted a token of his vocation by heaven itself. He had found what he had been sent into the desert to find, as Brother Francis saw it. He was called to be a professed monk of the order. Forgetting his abbot's stern warning against expecting a vocation to come in any spectacular or miraculous form, the novice knelt in the sand to pray his thanks and to offer a few decades of the rosary for the intentions of the old pilgrim who had pointed out the rock leading to the shelter. May you find your voice soon, boy, the wanderer had said. Not until now did the novice suspect that the pilgrim meant voice with a capital V.
Ut solius tuae voluntatis mihi cupidus sim, et vocationis tuae conscius si digneris me vocare.
It would be left to the abbot to think that his voice was speaking the language of circumstances and not the language of cause and effect. It would be left to the promotor fidei to think that Leibowitz, perhaps, was not an uncommon name before the flame deluge, and that I.E. could as easily represent Ichabod Ebenezer as Isaac Edward. For Francis, there was only one. From the distant abbey, three bell notes rang out across the desert, a pause, then the three notes were followed by nine.
Angelus Domini nunciavit Mariae,
the novice dutifully responded, glancing up in surprise to see that the sun had become a flat scarlet ellipse that already touched the western horizon. The rock barrier around his burrow was not yet complete. As soon as the Angelus was said, he hastily repacked the papers in the rusty old box. A call from heaven did not necessarily involve charismata for subduing wild beasts or befriending hungry wolves. By the time twilight had faded and the stars had appeared, the makeshift shelter was as well fortified as he could make it. Whether it was wolf-proof remained to be tested. The test would not be long in coming. He had already heard a few howls from the west. His fire was rekindled, but there was no light left outside the circle of firelight to permit the gathering of his daily collection of purple cactus fruit, his only source of nourishment, except on Sundays, when a few handfuls of parched corn were sent from the abbey after a priest had made his rounds with the Holy Sacrament. The letter of the rule for a Lenten vocational vigil was not so strict as its practical application. As applied, the rule amounted to simple starvation. Tonight, however, the gnawing of hunger was less troublesome to Francis than his own impatient urge to run back to the abbey and announce the news of his discovery. To do so would be to renounce his vocation no sooner than it had come to him. He was here for the duration of Lent, vocation or no vocation, to continue his vigil as if nothing extraordinary had occurred. Dreamily, from near the fire, he gazed into the darkness in the direction of Fallout Survival Shelter and tried to visualize a towering basilica rising from the site. The fantasy was pleasant, but it was difficult to imagine anyone choosing this remote stretch of desert as the focal point of a future diocese. If not a basilica, then a smaller church, the Church of St. Leibowitz of the Wilderness, surrounded by a garden and a wall, with a shrine of the saints attracting rivers of pilgrims with girded loins out of the north. Father Francis of Utah conducted the pilgrims on a tour of the ruins, even through Hatch 2, into the splendors of sealed environment beyond, the catacombs of the flame deluge, Well, afterwards, he would offer mass for them on the altar stone which enclosed a relic of the church's name saint. A bit of burlap, fibers from the hangman's noose, fingernail clippings from the bottom of the rusty box, or perhaps racing form. But the fantasy withered. The chances of Brother Francis becoming a priest were slight. Not being a missionary order, the Brothers of Leibowitz needed only enough priests for the abbey itself, and a few smaller communities of monks in other locations. Furthermore, the saint was still only a beatus, officially, and would never be formally declared a saint unless he wrought a few more good solid miracles to underwrite his own beatification, which was not an infallible proclamation, as canonization would be, although it permitted the monks of the Leibowitz order formally to venerate their founder and patron outside of the mass and the office. The proportions of the fantasy church dwindled to the size of a wayside shrine. The river of pilgrims shrank to a trickle. New Rome was busy with other matters, such as the petition for a formal definition on the question of the preternatural gifts of the Holy Virgin, the Dominicans holding that the Immaculate Conception implied not only indwelling grace, but also that the Blessed Mother had had the preternatural powers which were Eve's before the fall. Some theologians of other orders, while admitting this to be pious conjecture, denied that it was necessarily the case, and contended that a creature might be originally innocent, but not endowed with preternatural gifts. The Dominicans bowed to this, but contended that the belief had always been implicit in other dogma, such as the assumption, preternatural immortality, and the preservation from actual sin, implying preternatural integrity, and still other examples. While attempting to settle this dispute, New Rome had seemingly left the case for the canonization of Leibowitz to gather dust on the shelf. Contenting himself with a small shrine of the Beatus and a casual trickle of pilgrims, Brother Francis drowsed. When he awoke, the fire was reduced to glowing embers. Something seemed amiss. Was he quite alone? He blinked around at the encompassing darkness. From beyond the bed of reddish coals, the dark wolf blinked back. The novice yelped and dived for cover. The yelp, he decided as he lay trembling within his den of stones and brush, had been only an involuntary breach of the rule of silence. He lay hugging the metal box and praying that the days of Lent might pass swiftly, while padded feet scratched about his enclosure. Chapter 3. And then, Father, I almost took the bread and cheese.
But you didn't take it.
No.
Then there was no sin by deed. But I wanted it so badly I could taste it.
Willfully? Did you deliberately enjoy the fantasy?
No.
You tried to get rid of it?
Yes.
So there was not culpable gluttony of thought, either. Why are you confessing this?
Because then I lost my temper and splashed him with holy water.
You what? Why?
Father Cherokee, wearing his stole, stared at the penitent who knelt in profile before him in the scorching sunlight on the open desert. The priest kept wondering how it was possible for such a youth, not particularly intelligent in so far as he could determine, to manage to find occasions or near occasions of sin while completely isolated on barren desert, far from any distraction or apparent source of temptation. There should be very little trouble a boy could get into out here, armed as he was with only a rosary, a flint, a penknife, and a prayer book. So it seemed to Father Cherokee. But this confession was taking up quite a lot of time. He wished the boy would get on with it. His arthritis was bothering him again, but because of the presence of the Holy Sacrament on the portable table which he took with him on his rounds, the priest preferred to stand, or to stay on his knees along with the penitent. He had lighted a candle before the small golden case which contained the hosts, but the flame was invisible in the sun glare, and the breeze might even have blown it out.
But exorcism is permissible these days without any specific higher authorization. What are you confessing, being angry?
That too.
At whom did you become angry? At the old man or at yourself for almost taking the food?
I'm not sure.
Well, make up your mind, Father Cherokee said impatiently. Either accuse yourself or else not.
I accuse myself.
Of what? Cherokee sighed.
Of abusing a sacramental in a fit of temper.
Abusing? You had no rational reason to suspect diabolic influence? You just became angry and squirted him with it, like throwing the ink in his eye?
The novice squirmed and hesitated, sensing the priest's sarcasm. Confession was always difficult for Brother Francis. He could never find the right words for his misdeeds, and in trying to remember his own motives, he became hopelessly confused. Nor was the priest helping matters by taking the either you did or else you didn't stand, even though, obviously, either Francis had or else he hadn't.
I think I lost my senses for a moment, he said finally.
Cherokee opened his mouth, apparently meaning to pursue the matter, then thought better of it.
I see. What next, then?
Gluttonous thoughts, Francis said after a moment. The priest sighed.
I thought we were through with that, or is this another time?
Yesterday, there was this lizard, Father. It had blue and yellow stripes and such magnificent hams, thick as your thumb and plump, and I kept thinking how it would taste like chicken, roasted all brown and crisp outside, and...
All right, the priest interrupted.
Only a hint of revulsion crossed his aged face. After all, the boy was spending a lot of time in the sun.
You took pleasure in these thoughts? You didn't try to get rid of the temptation?
Francis reddened.
I tried to catch it. It got away.
So, not merely thoughts, deed as well.
Just that one time?
Well, yes, just that.
All right, in thought and deed, willfully meaning to eat meat during Lent. Please be as specific as you can after this. I thought you had examined your conscience properly. Is there anything else?
Quite a lot. The priest winced. He had several hermitages to visit. It was a long, hot ride, and his knees were hurting.
Please get on with it as quickly as you can, he sighed.
Impurity, once.
Thought, word, or deed?
Well, there was this succubus, and she...
Succubus? Oh, nocturnal. You were asleep?
Yes, but...
Then why confess it?
Because afterwards.
Afterwards what? When you woke up?
Yes, I kept thinking about her, kept imagining it all over again.
All right, concupiscent thought, deliberately entertained. You're sorry? Now what next?
All this was the usual sort of thing that one kept hearing time after endless time from postulant after postulant, novice after novice, and it seemed to Father Cherokee that the least Brother Francis could do would be to bark out his self-accusations, 1, 2, 3, in a neat, orderly manner, without all this prodding and prompting. Francis seemed to find difficulty in formulating whatever he was about to say. The priest waited.
I think my vocation has come to me, Father, but...
Francis moistened his cracked lips and stared at a bug on a rock.
Oh, has it?
Cherokee's voice was toneless.
Yes, I think, but would it be a sin, Father, if when I first got it, I thought rather scornfully of the handwriting, I mean?
Cherokee blinked.
Handwriting? Vocation? What kind of a question was...
He studied the novice's serious expression for a few seconds, then frowned.
"Have you and Brother Alfred been passing notes to each other?"
he asked ominously.
"Oh, no, Father." "Then whose handwriting are you talking about?"
the Blessed Leibowitz. Cherokee paused to think. Did there, or did there not, exist in the Abbey's collection of ancient documents any manuscript penned personally by the founder of the order, an original copy? After a moment's reflection, he decided in the affirmative. Yes, there were a few scraps of it left, carefully kept under lock and key.
Are you talking about something that happened back at the Abbey before you came out here?
No, Father, it happened right over there. He nodded toward the left, 3 mounds over, near the tall cactus.
Involving your vocation, you say?
Yes, but...
Of course, Cherokee said sharply, you could not possibly be trying to say that you have received, from the Blessed Leibowitz, dead now, lo, the last 600 years, a handwritten invitation to profess your solemn vows? And you, deplored his handwriting? Forgive me, but that's the impression I was getting.
Well, it's something like that, Father. Cherokee sputtered. Becoming alarmed, Brother Francis produced a scrap of paper from his sleeve and handed it to the priest. It was brittle with age and stained. The ink was faded.
Pound pastrami, Father Cherokee pronounced, slurring over some of the unfamiliar words. Can kraut, 6 bagels, bring home for Emma?
He stared fixedly at Brother Francis for several seconds.
This was written by whom?
Francis told him. Cherokee thought it over.
It's not possible for you to make a good confession while you're in this condition, and it wouldn't be proper for me to absolve you when you're not in your right mind.
Seeing Francis wince, the priest touched him reassuringly on the shoulder.
Don't worry, son, we'll talk it over after you're better. I'll hear your confession then. For the present...
He glanced nervously at the vessel containing the Eucharist.
I want you to gather up your things and return to the Abbey at once.
But, Father,
I command you, the priest said tonelessly, to return to the Abbey at once.
Yes, Father.
Now I'm not going to absolve you, but you might make a good act of contrition and offer 2 decades of the rosary as penance anyhow. Would you like my blessing?
The novice nodded, fighting tears. The priest blessed him, arose, genuflected before the sacrament, recovered the golden vessel, and reattached it to the chain around his neck. Having pocketed the candle, collapsed the table, and strapped it in place behind the saddle, he gave Francis a last solemn nod, then mounted and rode away on his mare to complete his circuit of the Lenten hermitages. Francis sat in the hot sand and wept. It would have been simple if he could have taken the priest to the crypt to show him the ancient room, if he could have displayed the box and all its contents, and the mark the pilgrim had made on the rock. But the priest was carrying the Eucharist, and could not have been induced to climb down into a rock-filled basement on his hands and knees, or to paw through the contents of the old box and enter into archaeological discussions. Francis had known better than to ask. Cherokee's visit was necessarily solemn, as long as the locket he was wearing contained a single host, although after it was empty, he might be amenable to some informal listening. The novice could not blame Father Cherokee for leaping to the conclusion that he had gone out of his mind. He was a little groggy from the sun, and he had stammered quite a bit. More than one novice had turned up with addled wits after a vocational vigil. There was nothing to do but obey the command to return. He walked to the shelter and glanced into it once again to reassure himself that it was really there. Then he went to get the box. By the time he had it repacked and was ready to leave, the dust plume had appeared in the southeast, heralding the arrival of the supply carrier with water and corn from the Abbey. Brother Francis decided to wait for his supplies before starting the long trek home. 3 donkeys and 1 monk ambled into view at the head of the dust streamer. The lead donkey plodded under the weight of Brother Fingo. In spite of the hood, Francis recognized the cook's helper from his hunched shoulders and from the long, hairy shins that dangled on either side of the donkey, so that Brother Fingo's sandals nearly dragged the ground. The animals that followed came loaded with small bags of corn and skins of water.
"Sooey, pig, 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 sooey, pig,"
Fingo called, cupping his hands to his mouth and broadcasting the hog call across the ruins, as if he had not seen Francis waiting for him beside the trail.
"Pig, pig, pig."
"Aha, there you are, Francisco. I mistook you for a bone pile. Well, we'll have to fatten you up for the wolves. There you are. Help yourself to the Sunday slops. How goes the hermit trade?" Think you'll make it a career? Just one water skin, mind you, and one sack of corn. And watch Melisha's hind feet. She's in rut and feels frolicky. Kicked Alfred back there, crunch right in the kneecap. Careful with it.
Brother Fingo brushed back his hood and chortled while the novice and Melisha fenced for position. Fingo was undoubtedly the ugliest man alive, and when he laughed, the vast display of pink gums and huge teeth of assorted colors added little to his charm. He was a sport, but the sport could scarcely be called monstrous. It was a rather common hereditary pattern in the Minnesota country from whence he came. It produced baldness and a very uneven distribution of melanin, so that the gangling monk's hide was a patchwork of beef liver and chocolate splashes on an albino background. However, his perpetual good humor so compensated for his appearance that one ceased to notice it after a few minutes. And after long acquaintance, Brother Fingo's markings seemed as normal as those of a painted pony. What might have seemed hideous if he were a sulking fellow managed almost to become as decorative as clown's makeup when accompanied by exuberant good cheer. Fingo's assignment to the kitchen was punitive and probably temporary. He was a woodcarver by trade and normally worked in the carpenter's shop. But some incident of self-assertion in connection with the figure of the Blessed Leibowitz which he had been permitted to carve had caused the abbot to order him transferred to the kitchen until he showed some signs of practicing humility. Meanwhile, the figure of the Beatus waited in the carpentry shop, half-carved. Fingo's grin began to fade as he studied Francis's countenance while the novice unloaded his grain and water from the frisky she-ass.
"You look like a sick sheep, boy," he said to the penitent. "What's the trouble? Is Father Cherokee in one of his slow rages again?"
Brother Francis shook his head.
"Not that I could tell."
"Then what's wrong? Are you really sick?"
"He ordered me back to the abbey."
"What?"
Fingo swung a hairy shin over the jackass and dropped a few inches to the ground. He towered over Brother Francis, clapped a meaty hand on his shoulder, and peered down into his face.
"What is it? The jaundice?"
"No, he thinks I'm..."
Francis tapped his temple and shrugged. Fingo laughed.
"Well, that's true, but we all knew that. Why is he sending you back?"
Francis glanced down at the box near his feet.
"I found some things that belonged to the Blessed Leibowitz. I started to tell him, but he didn't believe me. He wouldn't let me explain. He..."
"You found what?"
Fingo smiled his disbelief, then dropped to his knees and opened the box while the novice watched nervously. The monk stirred the whiskered cylinders in the trays with one finger and whistled softly.
"Hill pagan charms, aren't they? This is old, Francisco. This is really old."
He glanced at the note in the lid.
"What's this gibberish?"
he asked, squinting up at the unhappy novice.
"Pre-deluge English.
I never studied it, except what we sing in choir."
"It was written by the Beatus himself."
"This?"
Brother Fingo stared from the note to Brother Francis and back to the note. He shook his head suddenly, clamped the lid back on the box, and stood up. His grin had become artificial.
"Maybe Father's right. You better hike back and have Brother Pharmacist brew you up one of his toadstool specials. That's the fever, brother."
Francis shrugged.
"Perhaps."
"Where'd you find this stuff?"
The novice pointed.
"Over that way a few mounds. I moved some rocks. There was a cave-in and I found a basement. Go see for yourself."
Fingo shook his head.
"I've got a long ride ahead."
Francis picked up the box and started toward the abbey, while Fingo returned to his donkey. But after a few paces, the novice stopped and called back.
"Brother Spots, could you take 2 minutes?"
"Maybe," answered Fingo. "What for?"
"Just walk over there and look in the hole."
"Why?"
"So you can tell Father Cherokee if it's really there."
Fingo paused with one leg half across his donkey's back.
"Ha!"
He withdrew the leg.
"All right, if it's not there, I'll tell you."
Francis watched for a moment while the gangling Fingo strode out of sight among the mounds. Then he turned to shuffle down the long dusty trail toward the abbey, intermittently munching corn and sipping from the water skin. Occasionally he glanced back. Fingo was gone much longer than 2 minutes. Brother Francis had ceased to watch for his reappearance by the time he heard a distant bellow from the ruins far behind him. He turned. He could make out the distant figure of the woodcarver standing atop one of the mounds. Fingo was waving his arms and vigorously nodding his head in affirmation. Francis waved back, then hiked wearily on his way. 2 weeks of near starvation had exacted their tribute. After 2 or 3 miles, he began to stagger. When still nearly a mile from the abbey, he fainted beside the road. It was late afternoon before Cherokee, riding back from his rounds, noticed him lying there, hastily dismounted, and bathed the youth's face until he gradually brought him around. Cherokee had encountered the supply donkeys on his way back, and had paused to hear Fingo's account, confirming Brother Francis's find. Although he was not prepared to believe that Francis had discovered anything of real importance, the priest regretted his earlier impatience with the boy. Having noticed the box lying nearby, with its contents half spilled in the road, and having glanced briefly at the note in the lid, while Francis sat groggy and confused at the edge of the trail, Cherokee found himself willing to regard the boy's earlier babblings as the result of romantic imagination, rather than of madness or delirium. He had neither visited the crypt nor closely examined the contents of the box, but it was obvious at least that the boy had been misinterpreting real events rather than confessing hallucinations.
"You can finish your confession as soon as we get back," he told the novice softly, helping him to climb up behind the saddle on the mare. "I think I can absolve you if you don't insist on personal messages from the saints, eh?"
Brother Francis was too weak at the moment to insist on anything. Chapter 4
"You did the right thing," the abbot grunted at last. He had been slowly pacing the floor of his study for perhaps 5 minutes.
His wide peasant face, wearing a thick furrowed, muscular glower, while Father Cherokee sat nervously on the edge of his chair. Neither priest had spoken since Cherokee had entered the room in answer to his ruler's summons. Cherokee jumped slightly when Abbot Arcos finally grunted out the words.
"You did the right thing," the abbot said again,
stopping in the center of the room and squinting at his prior, who finally began to relax. It was nearly midnight, and Arcos had been preparing to retire for an hour or two of sleep before matins and laws.
Still damp and disheveled from a recent plunge in the bathing barrel, he reminded Cherokee of a werebear, only incompletely changed into a man. He was wearing a coyote skin robe, and the only hint of his office was the pectoral cross that nestled in the black fur on his chest and flashed with candlelight whenever he turned toward the desk. His wet hair hung over his forehead, and with his short jutting beard and his coyote skins, he looked, at the moment, less like a priest than a military chieftain, full of restrained battle anger from a recent assault. Father Cherokee, who came of baronial stock from Denver, tended to react formally to men's official capacities, tended to speak courteously to the badge of office, while not allowing himself to see the man who wore it, in this respect following the court customs of many ages. Thus Father Cherokee had always maintained a formally cordial relationship with the ring and the pectoral cross, with the office of his abbot, but permitted himself to see as little as possible of Arcos the man. This was rather difficult under present circumstances, the Reverend Father Abbot being fresh out of his bath and padding around his study in his bare feet. He had apparently just trimmed a corn and cut too deep. One great toe was bloody. Cherokee tried to avoid noticing it, but felt very ill at ease.
"You do know what I'm talking about," Arco scowled impatiently.
This book is continued on Cassette 2, Side 1.